Oh, I'll tell you what, we could start off with what's happened in the week or so since we last podcasted, because we haven't done that for a while.
What
So
has happened in the week or so since we last
nice
podcasted?
things.
What's happened in the month or so since we podcasted? Because we've both been taking it in turns to be sick.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Welcome to another Binro Was Right. I'm Betsy Chevron.
I'm Disc Grinder.
We'd like to apologise for radio silence,
yep.
Or podcast silence for a while. We've been taking it in turns to be sick.
Yeah.
Every time we've tried to book a date to record.
There's been lurgy.
But now we're both
fighting fit.
As well as we can be.
Raring to go.
With our lifestyles.
Yeah.
And we're ready to go again.
Yeah. But this time it's going to be slightly different because I think I mentioned this a couple of days ago, is that I've been very interested since a couple of people have been talking about it, particularly Al from the No Complications blog, who talked at length on how he thought Clara's story had a lot of resonances with Greek. I'm not going to say Greek myths. So what do I mean? Do I mean
tragedy?
Epics, tragedy? Yeah.
I think you mean tragedy.
So part of the reason, and I find that immensely interesting, and he used a few terms that I'd never heard before. And Betsy has a long and checkered history of being a classicist and a historian, and probably knows a lot more about, certainly knows more about this than I do. So what I wanted to do was just to kind of talk a little bit about, in an interview, Betsy, almost, about what storytelling is. Is it the same as narrative? And so on and so forth. So I start off with that question. Is there a difference between narrative and storytelling?
Yes.
Right. Okay. Well, that's got that one out of the way. So what is it? What is the difference?
Well, narrative is everything.
Right.
Narrative is the question, if a tree falls in the forest.
Yeah. Bishop Berkeley. Yeah.
Because everything is a narrative. Any human experience that can be expressed as a memory or is being recorded like this podcast right now is a narrative. This podcast is a narrative of our interaction right now.
Yeah.
Your memory of playing a card game with your boys last weekend.
Yeah. Which was brilliant.
There is a narrative to that. You get into the question of the fallibility of memory and whether the narrative is accurate.
Oh, right, okay.
But it's still a narrative as interpreted by us. So when I say the comparison with when a tree falls in a forest, the narrative is a tree has fallen in a forest, but if it's not experienced by anyone, it can't be expressed as a narrative.
Wow. And it's also not really a story, is it?
No, because, well,
there was
storytelling,
no antagonist.
there's little conflict.
Yeah. You made that point quite eloquently before about if there's no conflict, there's no story.
The essence of a story can't go anywhere unless there's some kind of conflict.
Yeah.
Conflict is the essence of storytelling.
Yeah.
So for narrative, which can be fiction or non-fiction, and storytelling, which can be fiction or non-fiction.
Right.
You know, when it comes to a narrative, you can have a child tell you about their weekend on Monday at school and nothing really happened.
Yeah.
But they're telling, you know. Yeah. It's not really a story if nothing happened, is it?
No.
So, because a story, you know, you're told as a kid a story has to have a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Yeah, it's the first, second, and third.
Whereas
act.
A narrative,
that's slightly different.
The narrative of human experience is continuous.
Yeah,
and that's probably slightly more metaphysical than you were going for.
No, it's quite nice though. Yeah, the narrative. Yes, it's ongoing.
There is no beginning, middle, or end to the narrative of human experience.
Yeah, so it's quite. That's an interesting point on that. It's like evolution. Is that there's a kind of crap idea that evolution has got a point. Is there's a teleological explanation for evolution is that we are getting better and better and better. As creatures evolve, they get better. You know, they become more superior. No, they don't. They just fit their environment better. And that's what that is. And it's continuous and there is no end to it and there's no point to it. There is no point to evolution other than to best fit your environment. So that's a slight digression. So narrative versus storytelling. So narrative is just the day-to-day, or my favourite word of the week, quotidian.
Well, storytelling is in itself a narrative. It's sort of the umbrella term.
Right.
So in the same way that a rectangle is a kind of oblong, is that correct, or is it the other way around?
No, they're both the same thing. A rectangle is a square is a special kind of rectangle, I think is the metaphor you're going for. Because it's nice.
Okay, so triangles, rectangles, they are all geometric shapes.
They're all polygons, yeah.
Narrative is polygon, storytelling is triangle.
Oh, nice, that's nice, yeah. Okay, so one of the things that...
maths.
Maths, lovely. Platonic solids, yeah.
Platonic.
Yeah, this doesn't sound quite as good as I thought it did in my mind. Yes, what are you on today? I'm on platonic solids.
But I'm hoping for more.
Yes, I'm hoping for more. And then, of course, one of the reasons why I say top a lot, I actually studied topology. That's a shit joke. That's right. So another thing that I've seen talked about in storytelling is the idea of story arcs and character arcs, and if there's a difference between them, and that a lot of the kind of paint-by-numbers Hollywood screenwriting, everybody has to have a story arc or a character arc. I mean, are they the same thing, or have I got my terminology mixed up?
Well, for a character to develop, they have to have some substance.
Yeah.
And you can call that substance an arc if you want.
Right.
Because...
Don't they have to go through some kind of setback and then learn from it? Or be punished for being
well,
a baddie.
Arc doesn't an arc doesn't have to be a fully formed a character arc doesn't have to be a fully formed journey.
Yeah.
Ideally it should be. You know, when you are asked about any character in a film or a book or a TV show, when you're asked about how they develop in it, you will be able to say, well, they are the doctor's granddaughter.
Yeah.
And they travel with the doctor.
Yeah.
And then their experiences of travelling with their grandfather is affected by the fact that two of their school teachers stumble onto the TARDIS and have an impact on the adventures they have.
Yeah.
And then one day they decide to leave the TARDIS.
Yeah.
And for us, that's the beginning is travelling, you know, living in TARDIS with grandfather. Middle, travelling with Ian and Barbara, end, falling in love and leaving the TARDIS.
Yeah, on war-torn Earth. But I have heard it told that Susan didn't really have a character development, is that she was pretty static, and then if she did have any character development, it was in the last six episodes of her career.
Well, that's experience. That's experiences that the character has, and therefore a character arc. Whether or not you feel that the character is well-developed in terms of how they're presented on screen is a completely different thing. That's different... Character and narrative are very different.
Right.
Because you can have a really engaging story where lots of exciting things happen to very dull people that you have absolutely no that you don't engage with at all.
Every Michael Bay film.
Well, that's not even exciting things happen. That's just a series of explosions happening to some very dull people.
Really nice phrase that somebody on crack.com came up with, drumsplosions. Which are just like,
ooh, I like that.
Drumsplosions, which is just drums that explode. Brilliant. But it's an easy trick to play, and a criticism that I think that I'm going to put forward is that you can build a plot just by creating character arcs and saying, well, this character is going to come against this obstacle, they're going to get over this obstacle. In the second act, it's going to be...
And that's a story for that character. Therefore, you've created a story.
Yeah. But can you have a story, to your point that you just made earlier, that doesn't have any character arcs in it? So, for example, I'm thinking of... Let me just pull one out of the air to say, does this have character arcs in it? Pyramids of Mars. Does that have character arcs in it?
Yes, I think, you know, to make it even more basic and not even talk about Doctor Who...
Right.
You could have a story. Imagine... Yeah. A high-speed camera watching a daisy grow.
The
story is the daisy growing.
Yeah.
Now, you can argue that the daisy, whilst not necessarily sentient, is our character.
Yes.
And therefore, its character arc is the process of growing, and then heavy rain or a dog walks over it and it gets crushed.
Right. And then
in that,
again.
You have a story
in
which something has grown from a beginning.
Yeah.
The process of growing is the middle... and the destruction of it is the end.
Right, yeah.
But at no point do we feel an emotional attachment to right. the Daisy. At no point do we feel empathy with the Daisy.
I see. So is the character arc all about that emotional attachment? Is making somebody sort of like identify with that character's journey, so to speak, and also that kind of thing is where.
There's a difference. I think possibly we need to establish the difference between character arcs and characterizations. Character arcs are stories.
Right.
Character arcs are story arcs specific to a character.
Right. Gotcha.
Characterization, however, is how we as an audience perceive that character through watching how they deal with their story arc.
Yeah.
So you'll have an A story and a B story, possibly a C story for each character.
Mm.
You know, let's talk about the Doctor's wife.
Mm-hmm.
The Neil Gaiman episode where the TARDIS is
made flesh.
The TARDIS is made flesh on the house.
Yeah.
And there we have the characters of aunt and uncle and Idris, who are living on the house.
Yeah.
And they have been, you know, their story, their character arc is that they have been perpetually rebuilt with the body parts of those who have landed there.
Yeah.
And House has fed on them.
Yeah.
And you've got the story arc of House himself. That's his character arc.
Yeah.
And you've got the character arc of the Doctor and Amy and Rory who come to land on House, and how the Doctor interacts with Idris and gets to interact with the TARDIS in a verbal fashion, and also how Amy and Rory hash out their relationship.
Yeah.
Now, they all have experiences in that episode, which are their own character arcs.
Yeah.
But we also get character developments when you get to discover through discussions how the Doctor and the TARDIS feel about each other and how Amy and Rory feel about each other.
Also that great bit in the where Matt Smith says something like, or the length Doctor, I should say, because in the universe, says something like, oh, is this me angry now? Because it was the first time he'd experienced anger. So you had a very definite feeling, well, that's a development for your character. And was a really lovely point in that thing. Another thing I wanted to talk about was the concept, and I don't know whether you know about this, but I've heard the concept of beats in a scene, and that there are beats that go throughout a scene. Do you know, have you heard that phrase? What are they?
That's just, think about it in musical terms.
Mm-hmm.
And pauses, beats are usually, in script writing terms, pauses.
Yeah. Really? Is that simple?
Between events. So it's a full stop. It's a narrative full stop. It is, this has happened.
Yeah.
So maybe it's a semicolon because it leads into something else.
That's nice.
But this has happened.
I like the music metaphor, because then there's the things like one of the things. Oh, my son told me about this actually. He's a great piano player. He was telling me about how melodies work, and what it is the pleasure that you get from a melody is the expectation of where it's going to go. So it's thinking of the future of the music, because if you think about it, you are hearing one note. So at any one point in time, you're hearing one note. It's what's gone before and what you think is going to come next, which gives you the pleasure. And he talked about things like resolution, like you resolve a melody.
So, which is why I find sonic dissonance in music so fun, which is why I love outsider music and noise music.
Because
the expectation is subverted.
Yeah.
Because where you expect a melody to go...
Yeah. And there's an enjoyment in that.
And it's surprising you. It's sort of like a jump scare in a film. It's a difference. If you're watching a horror film where the music tells you that something's about to happen, and then you get the scare, or it's banal, 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 banal. There's no indicator that a monster's about to jump out of the closet, and a monster just jumps out of the closet.
Yeah, yeah. That's much more effective.
Yeah.
So taking that metaphor on, so an unresolved melody or an expectation of how the story is going to go, if we're using the metaphor of melody versus story, and you expect it to go a certain way, and it does, you get satisfaction out of that. So if you see, the horror trope is like anybody who's slightly bad at the beginning of a horror movie, and it can
be... Anyone who has sex... Anyone who says, let's go down into the basement.
Yeah. Or does something unpleasant. And it can be just, just say something unpleasant to the protagonist, will get killed horribly. And that's the expectation. And that is, you get satisfaction out of it. A kind of minor satisfaction. So.
And that's why people are now writing cop buddy movies where someone says, I'm 3 weeks from retirement. And then they survive. because it subverts the expectation. Yeah. It's the sonic dissonance.
Yeah, that's great. So I get it. Another thing that's quite interesting to talk about is the concept of first, second, and third acts. And I have heard this told as well, is that the second act is the bit where the hero or heroine relaxes only for the scene to get dark, only for something even worse to happen, and then it's all resolved beautifully in the end. Have you got any thoughts on that?
Well, that's just a more elegant way of saying beginning, middle, and end.
Yes,
really. from the point of view of a classicist looking at the tragic model,
right?
You have in all tragedy,
usually
protagonists are people who, when we start, or just before we've started, have been in power, have been in a very comfortable situation.
Right.
They lose everything through some fatal flaw.
Of their own. Right.
And then in tragedy, usually there isn't a lovely resolution.
Right.
And really the acts are, first act, everything's wonderful.
Yeah.
Second act, things start deteriorating. Third act, everything's gone to shit. For the modern audience who need a happy ending, it's now everything's wonderful. Oh, everything's gone a bit wrong. Oh, everything's fine again.
Yeah.
So, or even things have been difficult for a while. Fight to make things better.
Yeah.
Fight pays off, and everything turns out okay in the end.
I was thinking it's similar to that, but I think there's a bit missing, which is that first act everything's fine, second act things turn to shit. You fight through it, and you get a kind of a resolution where you relax and you think everything's fine again. Then it gets even worse, and then everything's fine.
But that's all part of the second act.
Is it? All right. Okay.
There's a false ending in the second act.
A false ending. Yes, that's where I was going with that. Now, again, I've referred to it disparagingly as painting by numbers. I don't think that happens. That certainly didn't happen as much in Classic Who. I thought the stories didn't have as many character arcs in them, didn't follow the beginning, middle, and end, maybe because of the basic logistics of having something in 4 half-hour episodes, is that you can't physically have that structure. You know,
well, you've got to have a cliffhanger. You've got to have 3 cliffhangers and an ending rather than, you know,
the episodic nature. Now, that's an interesting thing, is the episodic nature of storytelling, like Sherlock Holmes being serialised in the Strand magazine to start off with, and things like that, and how that makes a very definite difference between classic Doctor Who and modern Doctor Who. Modern Doctor Who can run through that first, second, third act and character development all in one 45-minute block with 15 minutes for the American adverts. But classic Doctor Who had that episodic nature. Does it have a huge effect? I'm positing that it has a huge effect on the way the story runs.
Definitely. I mean, if you look back, let's disregard Trial of the Time Lord as one long narrative with subplots for now.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the fact that even by the end, you were getting 2, 3, 4-parters. Yeah. For Sylvester McCoy, nothing's more than 4 parts.
Right, really? Oh, okay.
Whereas Patrick Troughton, you've got the War Games, which is 10.
Yeah.
You've got 10, 12-parters early on in Doctor Who, where you're really pushing it. And it's essentially a single story over 10 weeks.
Yeah, yeah.
And over that time, you develop the story. You've got, you know, you seem to think that character wasn't as...
I
think when you have the luxury of time, you have more time for character in that. I also think that we miss that as a modern audience because we're so accustomed to the shorthand of character development now that a single line of dialogue can completely influence our perception of the character.
Yeah.
So
And has to. Yeah.
So you hear from Clara that Courtney Woods is a bit of an upstart.
Yeah.
And you know exactly what kind of kid she is in school.
Right, so you've got your shortcut there. So it's being told, not shown.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so everything she does after that,
yeah,
you just know, well, she's a bit of she's a bit of a, you know, a bit of a troublemaker in class. Yeah. Therefore, that's part of her character, and I'll apply that to everything she does.
Comeuppance on aisle six.
Afterwards. But you don't really, I mean, you do get that shorthand in some respects in earlier Doctor Who, but there's a lot more time to see characters interact and to see where characters' allegiances lie when there are when you're on a space station and there's someone who's essentially a double agent.
Yeah.
You get to see the shifty looks and things like that.
But it's a funny thing is, like, even though I'm diffusing my own argument, really, is of talking about character arcs and characterizations, I think I'm going to ask you this as well. There's been some amazingly memorable characters who are neither antagonists or protagonists in Doctor Who. Fantastically amazing. I've just thought of our favourite from Enemy of the World, who gets shot in the back, sadly.
Faria.
Yeah. Amazing. Such a memorable character.
And she really is given something. Yes, she's given great pathos, partly because she's just performed it so well.
Mm.
But we are explicitly told why she's doing what she's doing. Mm. She's doing it for her brother.
Yeah.
And there's an understanding with the audience for that. And yes, it only takes 30 seconds to explain that she is Salamander's food taster under duress to keep her brother alive.
Right.
And the audience...
But then you have the Australian cook as well in the same story, who's a fantastic character.
She's brilliant.
Yeah. And,
But then again, these are, in some cases, stock characters.
Yeah.
And they're stock characters that have been apparent throughout
the ages. What about the Master's, I don't want to say henchman, but acolyte in the second Auton invasion? Where his father gets killed by the horrible homunculus doll, and it's his son who's running the plastics factory, who's been completely taken over by the Master. I can't remember his name, but I thought he's a very memorable character as well. I mean, there's some amazing characters.
So memorable.
Solon from The Mutants. Fantastic.
Yeah. Anything Philip Maddock does as well is just always memorable.
Yeah, absolutely. I've mixed that out. It's not Solon.
Solon's in Brendan Mobby. Yeah.
Yeah. But I think the point being is they were kind of, did they develop in their stories?
Because is that about character or is that about
characterization and performance? Yeah, that's interesting.
Because we remember, you know, and is that also about recognising an actor? Because before we were recording, you mentioned Bernard Breslau, who you don't even see, who doesn't get, you know, if you don't know it's Bernard Breslau as an Ice Warrior or
King of the Cybermen,
you know that Bernard Breslau did it because that's part of the
lore. But the lovely fact is that you think that Bernard Breslau is the oaf in the Carry On movies, the big Sid James's henchman, right? But he was the man who invented the hissing voice of the Ice Warriors. That was his suggestion. Which is brilliant, you know. There's Sid James, mate. but we're getting slightly off the topic on storytelling. Al did use some terminology from Greek tragedy and comedy. What was it? One you talked about as well, which is which I found really interesting. What is it, diegetic?
Diegesis and diegetic, yeah. Which basically just means part of a fictional story.
Right.
So details about... So something that is diegetic is details about the story. Exposition is a diegetic form of storytelling.
Right, okay.
And the easiest way to describe it is diegetic and non-diegetic music, which I think is how we were discussing it at the time.
Oh yeah, that's right.
So we were talking about the Highlanders and the fact that there's an absence of a score and all you really get is the bagpipes and stuff. And because the bagpipes are being played in the story,
that's diegetic.
That's diegetic music.
Wow. All right.
Whereas Murray Gold, you know, so
Murray Gold's wonderful.
So if someone's singing a lullaby on screen,
that's diegetic.
That's diegetic music. If Murray Gold is spaffing all over something with an orchestra, that's non-diegetic.
And also known as shite. Yes.
In the same way that, so something you don't get in Doctor Who is a narrator.
Yeah.
Usually.
No, you don't. That's right.
You don't get a narrator saying, and then the Doctor da 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 da.
No. No.
Which is non-diegetic storytelling.
Right. Oh, okay, yeah.
Whereas diegetic storytelling is, come on, Zoe, come on, Jamie, let's go this way.
Yes. I'd like to have a hat like that, yeah. So,
yes. So the Doctor thought he should like to have a hat like that.
Is different.
Is non-diegetic.
That's why it's so jarring when you read a novelisation, when you are invited to... into the Doctor's mind to hear him think, to him, the Doctor thought. No, you fucking didn't. I'm not allowed to know that. You know, like, I'm reading a time novelisation.
You make a thought out loud sometimes.
Yeah, you think so out loud. That's different. That's different. That's not being told by the novelist or that, and the Doctor thought that so-and-so, and thought to himself, and they think, no, he didn't.
I think all of the doctors do think out loud.
Yeah.
I don't know why I said Tom Baker specifically, because all of the doctors do think out loud.
Yeah.
You get... William Hartnell holding his lapels and going,
John Pertwee rubbing the back of his neck.
John Pertwee rubbing the back of his neck. Patrick Troughton sort of nibbling on his index finger.
Oh, yes.
Adorable.
Yeah.
You know,
Peter Davison breathing heavily. That's all throughout the whole lot, though, isn't it? Yes. That's good. I didn't realise that.
They think out loud.
Yeah. It wasn't quite what I was.
But okay. Yes, I know what you mean. It's sort of the Doctor wondered what he would do next.
Yeah.
When in the story the Doctor would say, I wonder what I'll do next. Yeah. He'll sort of look quizzical.
And you would never be told what emotions the Doctor was feeling. Or you shouldn't be. So if I read novelisation, the Doctor was frightened. No, I don't know that. And I shouldn't be told that. You know, it's the difference between... it was a kind of storytelling technique or something you should never really do. You should never say he was angry... You should show his actions are that of an angry person.
Well, then you can say the Doctor shouted XYZ angrily.
Yeah, see, that's the thing. You're not supposed to do that. You're supposed to say the Doctor said this, and by the force of what the dialogue that he's actually said, you know that it's said in anger.
But you're talking about novelisations.
Yeah, that's a different thing.
And you're imposing the same expectations as you do on TV, but they're completely different media, and they're a completely different... modes and methods applied to storytelling in them.
Here's a question for you, though. This is we kind of touched on the difference between kind of like a single story in 45 minutes and an episodic story. Was there such a thing as like the Sunday matinee in Greek theatre? Would there be episodes, for example? Could they have big long stories? Because you talked about epics.
Well, not so much in theatre, but in epic, yes, because epics would be. I mean, it's an oral tradition. Nothing was written down for a long time.
Okay.
So when you think about Homer's epics, when you think about the Odyssey, Homer or someone would be at a dinner party. And ironically, it's actually in the Odyssey.
Yeah.
Most of the Odyssey is, when you think about it, Odysseus has landed on a beach and been taken in by a king because his daughter fancies him.
Yeah.
And to convince the king to give him ships so that he can get back to Ithaca, he tells the stories of his travels. So everything he says about meeting witches and monsters is him telling this story to the king.
Right.
Which is where, if I can digress, we get the question of whether or not the reliable narrator, which is why the Odyssey is compared to The Usual Suspects, everything he's saying, is it actually true?
Right, okay.
Is he just making it up to impress the king so that he'll get his ships?
Yeah.
But also, he's not just doing it all in one go. He's doing it over a series of nights at different dinner parties.
Yeah.
And that's how epic would have been received.
Like
Scheherazade. But those were different stories night on night.
Yeah,
and
just
in a way, this is different stories night on night. Because it's different episodes. So it's more like...
Did you do cliffhangers?
Yeah.
Oh, brilliant.
So this is more like a series with... Yeah. So this is more like modern series Doctor Who, where there's a bad wolf arc or there's the Impossible Girl arc.
Yeah.
So there's an individual story each night or week
which is
self-contained,
yeah.
but feeds into, and then he eventually got home.
Yeah, yeah. Fantastic. That's I think that's...
Of course, if you look at cave paintings, which is really the origins of our understanding of storytelling.
Yeah, they are stories as well.
They're stories as well.
Yeah.
And they go from room to room in catacombs telling episodes of stories.
There's that thought. I think I read it somewhere in something like The New Scientist, where they worked out that by the way that they had been drawn, that if you lit them and walked past them with a, you know, torch, flame torch, the way that the shadows were cast and obscured and then showed parts of the drawing actually told the story.
Ooh.
Which was quite amazing. It's almost like a very deliberate effect was that, if you can imagine, say, you can imagine the person standing in front of the pictures and holding up the torch and lighting one part of it and talking about that bit and then moving it slightly and then the next bit gets lit up, which is the next part of the story.
Yeah. Well, there was a BBC documentary series that was presented by Dr. Joanne Fletcher.
Oh, yeah.
Who I have a great big soft spot for.
Right.
And Egyptologist.
Right, all right.
And it was called Life and Death in the Valley of the Kings.
Right, yeah.
And the main focus of the three-part series was a man who actually designed tombs.
Wow.
For pharaohs.
Right.
And they explored his tomb. And, of course, in tombs,
yeah.
you would have wall paintings
yeah.
of depicting the life, which is a narrative and story in itself, depicting the life of the person who was entombed.
So as you walked that way, you were actually seeing this story.
Yeah.
So, right.
So I think that's a really good example of it. So if as you go through the different chambers of the tomb,
yeah.
Which are, you know, on the way to where the body is entombed yeah. itself and where his wife is entombed and yeah. things like that, you have... his story, his professional yeah. life, how great an architect he was,
yeah.
effectively, but also the story of his wife and children
wow.
on the yeah. walls. And that's episodic.
Moving pictures.
But every story is episodic. As we were talking about acts,
yeah.
even a 45-minute episode of Doctor
it's
Who
split into those...
is episodic.
Right.
So, let's take In the Forest of the Night.
Right, okay, yeah.
So, and you wanted to talk about character arcs and things, because the Doctor is, for a large portion of it, and Neve, they are split from Clara and Danny Pink yeah. and the other school children.
Yeah.
So for the school children, whilst everyone else has woken up and there are trees everywhere, they've woken up in a self-contained area because no trees have grown up through the floor of the... through the floor of the
museum
yeah. conveniently. And they are unaware of the world outside, and that is their beginning.
Oh, I
That's
see.
The start of their story arc.
Right.
Then they find their way outside.
Yeah.
And their challenge
yeah.
is... Well, then their various challenges, yeah. which are the different story arcs within it,
yeah.
are to find out what's happened
yes.
and whether or not that's a threat and how they can survive it.
Yeah.
To reunite the children with their parents, if possible.
Yeah.
And because they've lost Neve, find her.
Yeah. Right,
to
yeah.
find the doctor who might be able to help.
Right.
And then that's, you know, that's the first part of their journey and
right.
the objectives for that.
Yeah.
So that's their story.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
their
arc. And
then you get...
And throughout that we get the character development
yeah.
of... this little girl comes up and goes, sir, this, miss.
So at the end of that... episode within the whole thing is them finding the doctor. The next part is then
yes, yeah, so,
what the threat is.
So the end of that episode is they find the doctor
yeah.
and Neve, and then they're splitting up again and stuff.
Yeah.
But then there's the episode with the doctor where they discuss what's happening.
Yeah.
And that episode ends when Clara basically tells him to naff off.
Oh yes. Yes, yes. Yeah,
and
that's
then,
we're gonna save you.
And then the doctor has his, story where he works out what's going on, goes and retrieves the children,
yeah,
and they save the day.
Right, gotcha.
So there's yes. That's three acts.
Yeah, it is.
And those are all individual stories.
Yeah, yeah, amazing. I hadn't thought of it that way. That's the thing. It's like I find it endlessly fascinating what the mechanics are. You know how these things go together, and is it that simple? And that even though first started off by saying, well, there's clearly a difference between, you know, a four-parter and a 45-minute one on that. And what you've just kind of explained is not really.
No. Although so, it's funny how often I've heard people who aren't necessarily big fans of Doctor Who or who do enjoy the new series say, oh, I find the old series a bit slow.
Right.
Because there is the perception that, you know, in four 25-minute parts, that's actually not that much longer than, you know, that's the same length as a two-parter. And, you know, people people talk about The Impossible Astronaut and Day of the Moon or Silence in the Library, two-parter, or the Empty Child two-parter.
Yeah.
They people love those.
Yeah.
Similar in length to a four-parter.
Yeah.
But
has the storytelling got faster?
I don't think the storytelling has got faster. I think the production's got slicker.
Right.
And it's easier for a modern audience who are used to the Michael Bay style of editing and frequency of explosions.
Drum explosions. Yeah.
But, you know, when I say run, run, that's not new.
I mean, there have been episodes where, you know, I've got a little book up there which is written in 1980, which is about Doctor Who up until that time. And they talk about even there saying, well, this has got a lot of padding in it. You know, it was a six-parter and they could have cut it down to four.
Yes.
There's the run around in a bit and there's the bit when they're in prison again and they've been abducted, you know, Day of the Daleks. Well, how many times does John...
And what are we going to do with these characters whilst, you know, if you look at something like Terminus...
Yeah.
Well, in fact, it happened in every episode of the Black Guardian trilogy, but I've been watching Terminus... I watched Terminus recently... And in that, you know, the Doctor and Nyssa are together and then separated.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Tegan and Turlough
are
in an air vent, just sort of crawling around, doing very little. But every now and then, we'll cut to Tegan and Turlough, just so we know they're there.
Right, yes.
And just to give them something to do.
Yeah.
But all that that's really doing is saying they're still there, guys.
Yeah.
But it's not advancing enough.
No, no.
And there is lots of back and forth, to-ing and fro-ing,
yeah.
in the mode of what classicists would call new comedy,
right.
which a modern equivalent would be Friends, although not that modern.
So what is new comedy then?
Okay, well, was it about 200 second century BC, maybe?
Right. So when you say new,
well,
it's got a relative term.
Basically, there's not a great deal of, about sort of 300 and whatever BC.
Right, okay. Around about the time that everything got really shit.
Yeah.
Because it didn't. It ran around 300 years BC. There was like wars and wars and wars and wars.
Well, in Athenian comedy, there's old comedy and new comedy.
Right.
And old comedy is... largely represented by Aristophanes.
Right, okay.
And
him being the satirist, was it?
Or well, no, this thing, satire is a Roman term that comes a few hundred years later. However, I argue that Old Greek comedy is in itself satire, but by another name, because it does lampoon political and social constructs.
Right, okay.
And it lampoons politicians.
Mm-hmm.
But Old Greek comedy is very much a satirical take on current life.
Right, okay.
A lot of politicians didn't like that, which is why Aristophanes is the only person, is the only old Greek comic writer whose work survives in full and fragments in certain plays. And so he's the only example we have. But we can make a good guess that his contemporaries were also writing political content. We do
just
know
not on the winning side.
We do know that Aristophanes was taken to court by a politician called Cleon,
right?
And who sued him for effectively defamation of character in his plays. By the time Menander was writing, in sort of 300 and let's say I'm going to throw out 310 as a rough guess because I can't remember.
How many years after Aristophanes is that then?
Well, Lysistrata was won a drama competition in 411 BC.
So 100 years.
So 100 years difference.
So we're talking about the difference between, say, Martin Amis and Dickens.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. We're talking about the difference between Richard Brinsley Sheridan and Mrs. Brown's Boys.
Wow. That's a really good one. That's amazing. But that puts it in perspective because, like, my limited understanding of it would have lumped all of that together.
Mm.
So is it almost the case that the language was different, maybe? I mean, like, the way that, say,
well,
Sheridan,
the way that, I mean, the slang, the vernacular would have been different. Yeah. Obviously, ancient Greek is ancient Greek.
Right.
But the vernacular is different, certainly.
Yeah.
And the English dictionary hasn't changed very much since Dr. Johnson.
No.
It's just the words we use most often have changed.
It's like,
and a few bastardizations have made it in, and people have misinterpreted words.
Apparently one of the things that, and all my knowledge comes from QI, but apparently one of the catchphrases of the 19th century was, "Who are you?" And it was just like when anybody did something, like we would say "fuck off," they would just say like "Who are you?" as a kind of thing. So that's how that changed. But anyway,
that brings Alice in Wonderland into focus, doesn't it?
Yeah, doesn't it?
We're
talking about new comedy.
Yes, new comedy.
Yeah.
There was a very we don't have an entire play left from new comedy. The closest we've got is an almost complete play by Menander.
Right.
Called Old Cantankerous, or Discourse, which is about a grumpy old...
What was it called? Old Cantankerous?
Old Cantankerous.
Or
Discourse.
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 Now, that is quite ironic, isn't it? That somebody called Discourse was also...
Yeah!
I'm changing my name now. I'm going to be Discourse Grinder.
And that's good. I'd never thought of that. I'm quite annoyed at myself. It's because I don't like Menander. Because he wrote Friends.
Right. So your point being is Menander wrote basically the archetype for
Menander. Menander is Miranda. Menander writes comedy. I mean, Discalus is the story of a rich young man who is walking along the road and sees a really pretty girl.
Yeah.
Goes, "I'd like to marry her."
Yeah.
And then asks a slave, what's her deal? Says, no, her dad is a really nasty old prick.
Yeah.
He wouldn't give you the time of day. He really doesn't like rich, entitled boys like you. He
works in the fields. Right, there's nothing unreasonable about that.
Yeah, he works in the fields. God, you don't have daughters. He works in the fields. To impress him, you're going to have to prove that you can get your hands dirty.
The idea of a cantankerous man who doesn't like entitlement.
Yeah.
It's just, that's fantastic.
To impress him, you're going to have to prove you can get your hands dirty.
Right, okay.
And so that's the beginning of the story.
Right.
The middle of the story is this young man trying to work in the fields to impress the angry old man.
Right.
And so he's absolutely useless with a scythe. So you get lots of physical comedy of him sort of falling over, trying to cut. Well, quite. But there's also lots of one slave coming out of a door looking for another slave who's just gone in another door.
Oh, farce.
And it's very much slapstick and farce,
right,
with the odd fart and dick joke.
Right, okay. That's new comedy.
Yeah, that's new comedy. Yeah. Whereas old comedy was satire, biting political commentary with farting and dick jokes.
Right, so that was the week that was versus Monty Python.
That was the week that was versus Miranda.
Right. Okay. that was the point you make. Miranda is Miranda. Oh,
yeah,
that's brilliant.
Because I don't like Miranda, but yes, there's a bit more Monty Python. I think there was a little bit more. I think Monty Python's probably not the best.
No, it's too.
Because you need something with narrative structure.
Absurdist
to it.
As well,
you need something
it?
With narrative structure
yeah,
to it.
Yeah.
That's not absurd, because it wasn't absurdist.
No. Was there ever any kind of absurdism?
There's so much absurdism in old comedy.
Really?
There's a play called The Wasps.
That sounds good.
Which you'd love.
Yeah, yeah.
And again, it's about angry old men.
Yeah.
So
stripey fuckers,
The Wasps is one of the plays that really got Cleon's back up. Cleon is the politician that took Aristophanes
to
court.
Yeah, yeah.
And The Wasps is about Cleon and anti-Cleon. Is about pro-Cleon and anti-Cleon. Those are the names of the lead characters.
Fantastic.
Pro-Cleon is an old man who fought in the Peloponnesian War.
Right.
And is part of a social group who, because of their age, don't work, and their income comes from going to the assembly every day, where old men were paid one obol,
yeah,
is a unit of currency.
An obol.
An obol. to sit, listen to listen to the oligarchy,
yeah,
make their political cases, and then vote.
Oh, right, okay.
And one of Aristophanes' big bugbears was that Cleon was manipulating these older men,
right,
into supporting him.
Yeah.
And he wasn't really taking Athens' best interests.
Oh, okay, right.
In mind, and he was basically, Aristophanes didn't support him, or if you really want to argue it, whoever sponsored Aristophanes to write his plays.
Right.
Because
so Cleon was gerrymandering, basically, or,
yeah,
you know,
pretty
buying
much
votes. Yeah.
And so the idea behind the Wasps is the chorus is a load of old men, much like Procleon,
yeah,
who come and take Procleon and say, let's go to the assembly now and do our voting.
Yeah.
And they're dressed as wasps with massive stings. And of course, at the same time, every character in old comedy would also be wearing a massive leather phallus.
What?
So these men would be walking around with wasp asses and gigantic erect cocks.
What? Really?
I love old comedy.
What?
So,
that's amazing.
This is really off topic, but I'm quite enjoying
brilliant.
It.
That's something I never thought I would ever have known. Greek old comedy was all about massive cocks.
It was all about massive cocks. I'll tell you another one. So, in Wasps,
yeah,
Anticleon and one of his slaves are sort of going, how are we going to stop my dad,
yeah,
going and voting? And yeah, so they imprison him in the house.
Yeah.
And then this chorus of wasps with their giant cocks and stings try and help him escape. And there's one scene in which he mimics the Odyssey.
Yeah.
And if you remember the Odyssey, when he's trapped by the Cyclops,
yes,
they escape by blinding him, and then he and his men hold on to the underside of the because the Cyclops is a shepherd and has all of his sheep.
Yes.
And so when he's been blinded, he still has to let his sheep out the next day.
So they
cling on to the bottom of the sheep.
Brilliant.
So there's a mimicry of that,
yeah,
in Procleon, I think, grabbing onto the bottom of a mule or something,
right,
and riding the bottom of a mule as it leaves the house,
yeah,
to try and get out so that he can go
ass
and vote in the courts.
Yeah.
So that's pretty absurd.
Yes, yes, I think that is. But why the cocks? Was that just a thing? Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, there are a lot of questions that are,
yes,
unanswered.
Yeah.
The Greeks really did like cock.
Yes, that's the old joke about the Romans and the Greeks talking about the Romans and the Greeks having an argument about who invented what. And the Greeks saying, well, we invented mathematics. And the Romans said, yeah, well, we invented the arch. And the Greeks saying, well, we invented sex. And the Romans said, well, we invented having it with women.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because if you look at Roman art,
yeah,
you'll often see schoolboys looking at Roman statues sniggering at the small penises. Because a large penis was considered indicative of...
being Greek?
Not being Greek, of being a savage.
Really?
Yes.
Yes.
Of course, if you are highborn and intelligent,
yes,
and effeminacy is encouraged, perhaps you might have a lower testosterone level, and that might cause a smaller penis. I'm not a geneticist,
off talking about storytelling and narrative and being very, very intelligent and
now we're talking about,
now we're talking about
small cocks.
Small cocks in Rome.
Yeah.
And they all spoke Greek in Roman thing, apparently, didn't they?
The Romans had a bit of a chip on their shoulder about the Greeks. They did speak Greek.
Yeah.
The highborn ones did speak Greek as a sort of impressive foreign language. Yeah.
Yeah.
But Greece was the seat of knowledge.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
So.
But not. No
and
arches.
They copied a lot of Greek stuff. That's why I'm. That's why I'm. I'm a scholar of the Attic history and Greek rules.
Yeah. I read something really lovely about the fact that all of Greek statues were very, very heavily painted.
Yeah.
You know, bright green and
really,
blue.
Really heavily painted, and it's all gone now.
Yeah, and it's all gone. And they were saying that
everyone talks about how beautiful
classic
these
marble.
White marble statues. Yeah, they didn't.
But they
like
had
that.
Terrible, uncanny valley eyes painted and all that kind of stuff. And the way that it was explained, it would be like as if like 1,000 years from now. All that we had left was shop mannequins that all of the clothes had rotted off, and what the people then would think that we did. They'd say, well, they would have these massive streets with glass windows full of these amazingly plastic naked statues. Mm. And what was that all about? I said, well, they've just closed them, these. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah.
But that's why written artifacts are so important in classics.
Yeah.
Including fiction, to get back to the topic.
Yeah, well done.
Including comedy,
yeah.
Tragedy, epic,
yeah.
And historical and philosophical accounts. That's why written accounts of history is so important, including Doctor Who one day.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because people will know, you know, watching, again, In the Forest of Night, people will know what kids wore in 2014 from watching
certainly.
In the Forest of Night if all of the other artifacts are gone.
Yeah.
You know, we've got an account in another one of Aristophanes' plays, a character has to dress up as a woman because that old chestnut never gets old. In another one, load of female characters have to dress up as men. So,
but what's the difference?
They all wore
togas.
No, they didn't all wear togas. That's the point.
Do
you know why we know that they didn't all wear togas?
No, I don't. Want.
Well, partly because we've got receipts, effectively, from you know dressmakers and things like that, so we know what people wore. But also because we've got these plays with loads of women dressing up as men.
Yeah.
And describing stealing their husband. No, they actually say in the dialogue, because they weren't stage directs, they say in the dialogue,
right.
I stole my husband's cloak,
yeah.
And I've stolen his shoes, and I've been knitting my beard for weeks. I've stopped shaving, and I've been when my husband's been at work, I've been oiling my body and standing out in the sun so that I can get a tan, so we know that men were dark and women stayed pale.
Right, yeah.
And we know that women depilated, A, because of that, and B, because in another one of Aristophanes' plays where a man has to dress up as a woman to infiltrate a religious festival, they singe the hair off of his body and it's really painful and really, really demoralising. We've also, from Roman baths, we know that people shaved and also that part of their cleansing ritual was to cover themselves in oil and then use blades to scrape
called
it off.
Called a stridgel or something
called
like?
A stridgel, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah.
I know a little bit.
So, and that in itself is a narrative.
Yeah.
That is the narrative of ancient Rome. The storytelling of ancient Rome
is what
comes from historians and playwrights.
Fantastic.
And the same thing is true of Doctor Who, the same thing is true of every fiction and every non-fiction.
Brilliant. Do you know what? I think that's a fantastic conclusion to our little chat. I think that you nailed it. Little chat we've had there. So, no, that's totally enough. Thank you, that's brilliant.
Thank you, I really enjoyed that.
Yeah.
Apologies if you're expecting anything about British science fiction, but if you didn't know about...
this was our historical
Greek
set,
comedy
so.
From 4th century BC onwards, now you do.
Yeah, I certainly know a lot more than I did. Especially the bit about the cocks, that's amazing.
Oh, yeah.
But one of the things you did say, because just false end there, was that there were no stage directions and it was all done through dialogue.
Mm.
So how did they? So there must be dialogue in there saying, "Look at his cock."
Yeah. Yeah. Lysistrata is a great one because that's the one where the women stop the war. They go on sex strike.
Yes, that's right.
And the men are walking around going, I can't cope with this sex strike anymore. I've got the biggest boner you could possibly imagine. My balls are as blue as the ocean. That's the kind of stuff they say.
Did they? Really?
Yeah.
So they had a concept of blue balls, even then?
Yeah, they had a concept of all kinds of things. There are graphic descriptions of sex acts in some of them.
Right.
There's a play called The Knight, also by Aristophanes, in which he's denigrating a real politician of the time.
Right.
And trying to imply that he's effeminate because he soils his chin nightly.
Soils his chin nightly. Oh, right. I see.
And that's not something men did.
No.
Not if they wanted respect.
He soils his chin.
So,
what a lovely phrase.
Just to reiterate, this isn't a podcast for kids.
No.
but I think we should probably stop before it gets to be a podcast that's not for anybody. Yeah. In the meantime, you can find us on Facebook at Bin Rovers Right Podcast. You can find us on Twitter at Bin Rovers Right and individually at
Disc Grinder
and Betsy Chevron.
Yay.
And we're on iTunes and Feedburner and binrowwasright.blogspot.co.uk.
Yeah, fantastic. And iTunes.